This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we take part in a bittersweet reunion of workers for what was once known as the greatest show on Earth. And then Seattle radio journalist Martha Baskin reports on the kiddie version of the farm-to-table movement. So now, let's go inside the Compass. In January of 2017, Feld Entertainment announced that Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus would close after 146 years of touring the country. The Ringling Brothers Circus was founded by the five Ringling Brothers in their hometown of Baraboo, Wisconsin in 1884. In July of each year, the community of Baraboo hosts a famed Big Top Parade and circus celebration in conjunction with the Circus World Museum. This year, the hometown of the Ringlings invited all former artists and working men and women of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus to a circus homecoming. 35,000 spectators lined the streets of Baraboo for the event. It was an emotional reunion, and KPTZ DJ and reporter Chris Bricker, who formerly worked as a Ringling clown, was there. He brought back this report about the end of an era, along with some personal stories from workers for whom the circus was their life.
Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus was divided into two simultaneously traveling unit trains, the red and the blue. Each train carried about 326 performers, staff, and maintenance crew. Each train consisted of about 55 cars, weighing a total of about 4,000 tons, and with an overall length of about 4,900 feet. The Blue Unit was my home when I traveled with the show, and during that time, some of the veterans of the 1940s and 50s still cared for the train. In this installment, we hear from some of the unsung train and transportation workers who took care of that home in recent years and who witnessed the closure of the greatest show on Earth. Chad Ridge had some stories. He drove the train shuttle bus on both the Red and the Blue Units over the years.
Well, I'm a small kid from the state of Maine who basically fell in love with the circus from a young age. Unfortunately, Ringling Brothers never came to Maine, so my only outlet for the circus was the Shrine Circus. And every April for spring break, I would run away and join the circus for a week. So I would have the opportunity to meet some of the best acts in the world. However, my dad would take me down to Boston every year to audition for Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown College. I just never made it on the greatest show on Earth. However, when I was 16 years old in 1988, I met the Espana family. They came to town after just winning a Monte Carlo bronze clown for their flying act, and they were with the Shrine Circus, and they fell in love with me. I fell in love with them, and I literally had the opportunity. My dad gave me permission to run away and join the circus. And it was great because I actually learned how to clown, European-style clowning, from Papa Espana and others who had came through the area. And so I was learning how to be a professional clown. That year, Tim Holst had actually come to the Espanas to offer them a contract for the following tour, and he saw me rehearsing. He came up to me and says, "I like what you're doing, kid. How would you like to go to clown college?" And I looked at him, and I didn't know who he was. And I said, "Well, sir, I'm sorry. I'm learning how to be a real clown." And he kind of chuckled and handed me his business card and said, "If you change your mind, here you go." I'd gone on to be a clown, the world's youngest ringmaster on other shows. Later on, I had gotten my CDL, and what circus doesn't need a CDL driver? So I became the bus driver on the show, and over many years, I'd jump back and forth when they needed me to be the bus driver, and I was one of the last bus drivers on the Blue Show. And I happened to be there the night that Mr. Feld came to us and gave us the dreadful announcement that he and his family had decided to kill the circus.
Did that just come out of left field?
Well, we suspected that they were going to close one of the units and all of that, but it was a strange situation. That night we had found out that we were getting a new train master, so we figured that there was going to be, they called a butts in the seats meeting, a mandatory meeting for everybody to be there, and we thought they were gonna do some house cleaning about the new train master and some new rules and how the season was going, because it was in Miami, our first city, and we didn't think anything of it. But then now we started getting calls from the Red Show that they were going to have a meeting as well. It was kind of scary. I was ordered to get back to the train and to wait at the train, and I was to take all the train crew and any family members. The train crew were ordered to clear the train. All staff and family members had to be on my bus, and I was to get them in there by 9:45. While I'm corralling everybody, one of the train crew got a call from somebody on the Red Show stating that there was armed guards protecting the Red Show train in Orlando. That threw up some really big alarms for us. As we left, I noticed a couple of SUVs pull into the yard. Those guys had guns on them. We didn't know what was happening. I got there, and I was greeted by Ringling Security and the operations manager, who told me that I had to be the last one in. I was to make sure that all of our people were going in the building, and that they would let me know when I could get into the building. But they didn't want anybody leaving the building from our show. I was the last one in, and we get into this room, and the entire cast is there. And Tree comes up. Tree is the circus operations manager for both units. He comes up and says that Mr. Feld has an announcement, and then out comes Mr. Feld. It was obviously a very scripted, word for word, what was on the website wording, which is not like Mr. Feld. Anybody that knows Mr. Feld knows that he says what he has to say, and it's right to the point. Whether he has a smile or a frown, he just says what he has to say, and that's it. And it's never a scripted thing. You could hear a pin just drop. It was so quiet. He immediately got off the stage. Harry Sugarman, the head of HR, jumped up. Tree came up, and Mr. Feld was escorted out of the building. Feeling on the show was disbelief. People had just learned that they were losing their life as they knew it. People who had started families, who had been on the show for 20, 30, 40 years. We were just another one of his paper spreadsheets in the morning. That's all that we were. He'd look at his numbers and say, oh, Monster Truck made millions. Oh, Disney on Ice made millions. Oh, Ringling Brothers, they lost.
The trend had been to not use wild animals in circuses and in entertainment. So would that have been a viable opportunity?
For the guests that come to our shows, absolutely. Because the people that come to Ringling Brothers come to experience the animals. There is, and it's a proven fact, that it's a very vocal minority of people who are against animals in the circus. The circus itself has never done a PR campaign about how well their animals are taken. The fact is, Ringling has never been in violation for animal cruelty. And they saw the drop immediately when they took the elephants off. The arenas are out there. The problem is that Feld has still tied up those arenas with his other shows, and he can do so. So he puts, like, they're opening Moana up. So he puts Frozen and Moana in one of those shows is taking the place of Ringling. Right now, Marvel is actually taking the place of the old Ringling route. They're playing all of the dates that the Blue Show would have played this year from Los Angeles, all of those California dates.
So they swapped the commitments out is what they did.
That's all they did, and they can easily do that. But there is a passion for circus, and people are crying about it. They want the circus. They want the animal. Anybody that's performed on the show knows that they have a great marketing and PR team, but they stop marketing and PR about the animals.
Well, I imagine the Elephant Conservation Center is probably facing a number of retirees from the road.
Absolutely. I mean, from what I'm hearing, and this is just circus gossip, but they don't really have any elephants left there. All those elephants have been sent off to zoos or sold off or given away or been relocated. So the whole aspect of retiring the elephants was even a smoke and mirrors.
I know a number of cities have passed ordinances against using animals in shows. Regardless of what we think or what anyone thinks, that was a factor.
I believe so. But again, with Feld's power, nobody that can put as many shows right now, family shows, as Feld. I mean, there are concert promoters that can put as many shows in there. But Feld is actually rivaling a lot of concert promoters, putting 6 to 8 shows in some venues a year.
When all is said and done, reasons for closing, hard feelings, we know that it was something that came out of left field for the performers. A lot of people with family ties back home in their respective countries, people that had family ties here in the United States that had to go home. Pretty much no leeway that was given. They just had to leave. Having said all that, what was the feeling like when you left the train yard, when you left the lot for the very, very last time?
It was tough because I had a chance to see the transition. I was there as a kid where Clown Alley was a sacred place. Young kids would chase and try to sneak into the showgirls' dressing room. You know, and that's as much trouble as we got into. But people were fined on the show for not doing their jobs. And towards the end, there was just no care, no respect for what the show was. to see that and to sit there in the yard in New Jersey as I left the show for the last time, I had to wipe away the tears. As performers, we work, producers cancel shows all the time. To know that there were clowns who have a background in entertainment, they'll be able to go entertain or they'll be able to go on to other things. But the working guys who had been there for 15 plus years, you took their home away from them. You took their livelihood away from them. Even here in Baraboo, we're sitting here in Baraboo, there's two gentlemen here who are stuck. They have no money. They have no life. They don't know where they're going. But those people, my heart ached. I'm 43 years old. I can go find a job. These guys are as old as my grandparents, and they have nothing.
Where do you think the circus is going to go now in the United States?
The circus evolves about every 50 years. People said that you could never take a circus out of a canvas, and we've taken a show out of a canvas. You can never put a circus on rails. Things have changed. Things have evolved over the years. I think the circus will evolve. I hope that it does with animals because people, especially kids, have to have that kind of connection. The way I like to remember it, as a great ringmaster used to say, the circus is the oldest form of family entertainment. It's rated G for children of all ages, and it's never been censored.
Hi, my name is Brett Gerdemuller. I had a young man that I was mentoring in the railroad community in New England, and he wanted to get out of New England and get a railroad job where he could go kind of see the world, and I found that Ringling Brothers was looking for car mechanics, so I sent him to apply, and he became a car mechanic on Ringling, and then they needed a chief mechanical officer on the blue unit, and he called me and said, hey, would you be interested? And at that point, I was in need of a good life reset. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. And Joe Colosa, the train master from the blue unit, called me and hired me on as a chief mechanical officer, and that's how I got started. I got promoted and moved over to the red unit as train master, and I stayed there till the end of 2015.
For our listeners out there that don't know what the duties of a train master are, can you kind of run down those?
The train master is really the person who is responsible for everything outside of the building. He's responsible for the safety, health, and welfare of the 280 to 300 people that live on the train. He's responsible for the loading and unloading of the train, interfacing with all the railroads, taking care of ordering fuel, water, making sure the sewage is done. Basically, the train master is the guy who moved the show, and he's responsible for everybody when they're on the train. We had 13 other people that worked for me, so it was a 14-man train crew in total.
A lot of load-ins, a lot of load-outs.
We were out on the road all except for 3 weeks when we were mid-tour and 6 weeks when we were rebuilding a new show. And the longest we stayed in any one place was 2 weeks. You were loading at least every other week, you know, so that's 52 weeks in a year. Let's just say that we did 40, what would you say, Jerry? We did like 45, 46 loadouts in a year.
At least that.
You know, so lots of load-ins, lots of loadouts. Very long days, long hours. Days bled into days, bled into days. The train crew worked some of the longest hours on the show, and we were the people that no one ever saw, because if we did our job right, no one knew.
What did it feel like, not only with the closing, but this particular weekend?
I didn't really watch the last show. I wasn't there. I sort of let myself deal with the closing in my own way. So coming here this weekend was kind of the closure, and just being back in Baraboo and seeing the immense outpouring of support and love for all of us circus people, you know, and then meeting people that didn't even work with me on the show, like older people, there was automatically a connection. It was like we were immediately best friends. The sawdust runs deep around here. Runs deep and it runs thick.
My name is Charlie Isham. Originally raised in Texas. Went to the circus in 2011. I was hauling military equipment for the Army and Navy, and And I sold my truck completely out, and I looked online and got put out applications for electrician and a porter. And went to Mr. Mike, and I told him I didn't know everything about electricity. He said, nobody knows everything.
So, Charlie, this is a special weekend. We're all here in Baraboo, Wisconsin. First of all, what was your feeling when the show closed?
They got us, brought us all, everybody in, and told us the show was going to close. All our hearts fell on the ground. Some people just give up the ghost then. Some people stay to the end. Seeing people I didn't know, and some of the clowns I did remember, like Julie and a few others, a little heart came back, but still sad. Because everybody's going to scatter, and a lot of people you'll never see again.
There's some sadness and there's some happiness, isn't there?
Oh, yes. Happiness is seeing people I hadn't seen in a few years, or I didn't know them when I knew them, but I do know them now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Charlie. So sure appreciate talking with me.
Appreciate it. Make all day service days.
Coates from West Point, Virginia. I started on train crew, ended up as one of the porters also, but I was not mechanically inclined, to say the least. The show recognized that. I ended up in first wardrobe for a short time when I started in 1985, and ended up on Ring One props with Don Larson, and I stayed there for 4 years. And the fourth year of that, I was also doubled as the mailman, which is a very popular job on that show. Yeah. And after that, left for a time, came back several different years in a row. I got broken and rebuilt by this show, and more than once. And each time I realized, you know what? This is what my parents tried to get me to do growing up. And Ringling's people finally showed me the way. So I have that to be grateful for everybody on the show. The Ringling family and their legacy, Mr. Barner, Mr. Bailey, Irvin and Israel Feld, that revitalized it. 60s, 70s, and 80s, and I'm like, I cannot believe I'm part of this. Charlton Heston took part in 1951 tour in the movie. I mean, these are people that I grew up admiring, and then I realized, oh my God, what am I part of this thing? And it's overwhelming to have been a part of the largest theatrical performance in Earth's history. So large, it took a pair of mile-long trains to move it when I was on part of it.
Major emotions over this weekend and the closing of the show.
It's almost back when I was on the Blue Unit on May 21st this year, and we were closing it down. I actually held it together even when Jonathan Iverson called the entire production staff and crew, train crew, everybody on the floor at the end. I was holding it together pretty much until I got backstage when I had been taught by Victoria Razzo to pull the curtain. I had special gloves on that printed up with the RBBB 146 on it. And Victoria and I, we pulled the final curtain close together. And I'm like, we looked at each other like, oh my God, what did we just do? And even then I was still holding it together, and I walked across the backstage where the motorcycle glove was sitting, and I saw Jonathan Iverson's daughter and her best friend were wailing in tears because they were being pulled apart because their families are going to different places. Then that is where I fell down the floor and lost it. And it took me a good, kind of tearing up now. We finished the teardown at sunrise the following morning with the help of the theater crew up there, and they were just awesome. Everybody else was being bussed over to the airports to fly off to wherever in America or all across the planet. And on the following morning, I'm sleeping in my car on the train. And Marcus, the head porter, knocked on the door and said, Red, you still in there? I said, yep. Okay, get ready to move because we are going to shut down the power at 8 o'clock, just under 30 minutes. I'm like, uh-oh, okay. I'm moving out my stuff, and my car is parked right outside the coach. And I happened to look up. I was moving stuff, and I saw the head electrician and his assistant looked at his watch and said, 8 o'clock, let's go. And I shut the door of my car to get the last bag of stuff out of my car and put my key up. And I saw the light on the vestibule, both the vestibule cut off. And I went, oh, that's it. It's over. And put my key on the desk in the door, shut it, and walked out. And that afternoon, we saw the train roll out, and that was all. So it's very emotional. When you get to know people as well as your family for that long, it hits you.
Goodbye to you, long silver train. You kept me in your cradle in the sun and the snow and the rain. Rock-a-bye, we thank you for all you have done. You've shown us so many places, how to fly not too close to the sun. Now it's time to rest and for us to be on our way. But no, we'll see you down the road someday.
This is Chris Bricker for KPTC Community Radio News.
Repairing the disconnect between urban kids and the source of the food they eat is a core program of Launch Learning, the Seattle-based after-school and daycare program profiled today by KPTZ correspondent Martha Baskin.
Some things get people who care about access to locally grown farm food talking. That's the way it is with Rainbow Chard for Claire Chenard and Teresa Alfonso Mendez. Both work in the world of childcare at Launch Learning, an after-school and daycare program. Rainbow Chard just arrived with a delivery of local produce at one of Launch's kitchens. There are turnips, melons, cucumbers, tomatoes, and onions and carrots, which Alfonso Mendez will use in soup. But Rainbow Chard is new to her. Chenard, recently hired as nutrition coordinator and cooking coach for all 10 Launch Learning sites, has some ideas. Chard goes great with quesadillas.
And so we're going to put that inside of the quesadillas with cheese. Yeah.
Is it sweet?
It's actually savory. So instead of spinach, you can sneak that in, and it is just full of vitamins and minerals.
Alfonso Mendez says she'll chop it up.
And make it into like really thin strips to just kind of put in with the cheese then.
Launch Learning, formerly Community Day School, stands out in the childcare industry for affordable before and after school and pre-K child enrichment programs. Nutritious, locally grown food goes with the territory. The bright fluorescent stem of the chard is a natural for children, says Chenard, especially when added to things they're familiar with.
They love it, and they wonder why it's so good. And then we can talk about it. We can show them this beautiful, brilliant color and just this leaf that is so big. And then the pink is such a beautiful contrast.
Chenard is righteously enthusiastic. There aren't too many before and after school programs committed to ensuring kids, regardless of means, get nutritious, locally grown food. Add her new title, nutrition coordinator, and Launch is breaking ground. She digs in the farm box and pulls out Hakare turnips. These tiny Japanese turnips are perfect as a key ingredient to make soup come to life, says Chenard. Today's supper, as Launch staff call it, is on the table. It's called supper because many kids may go without any food until they return in the morning. Street tacos are the main course, with local pears for dessert, says cook Teresa Alfonso Mendez. Tortillas, local feta, cheddar, salsa, ground beef, cabbage. Unlike school,
they get to serve themselves. It's not a, I have to eat everything that's put there and it's already put together for you. They get to put it together themselves.
A group of kids comes into the lunchroom after playing outside. Their teacher, Jacob Williams Briner, asks if they have plates, forks, and a smile.
Somebody has a fork?
Yes.
What about a smile?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
What do they think about the food?
Delicious.
Which part?
Everything.
Also, it's fantastic.
Williams Briner, who lived in China for a while, is teaching the kids a little Chinese.
Usually when we get into seconds or thirds, then we start doing a little bit of trivia. Makes it a little more fun.
He asks if they remember the word for apple.
In Gual is apple. Do you remember what Gual is?
Fruit.
Fruit.
So how do you say I want fruit, he asks.
Guayao.
Fruit.
Guayao.
Fruit.
Gual.
When kids come from diverse global communities, as they do at Launch Learning, which operates primarily from South End schools, he says,
you can do the macro and the micro, giving them a global perspective with a local community.
Small rustic farms throughout Seattle's fertile neighboring valleys are a big part of the local community. It's their fruit and vegetables, chemical-free with a low carbon footprint, that make up many of the meals and snacks served at Launch Learning. Farmstand Local Foods is the link. The small startup's motto is bridging the gap between fields and kitchen.
Basically, we act as a service that carpools food into town for farmers.
Manager Austin Becker.
And connects them with new buyers and boosts their supply power.
One small farm can't grow enough to serve customers from high-end restaurants to childcare centers, but couple them with a marketing force like Farmstand Local Foods and you multiply their power. Launch Learning's farm-to-table program began as a partnership with the City of Seattle, a partnership that initially included 80 preschools. For every $250 a school spent, they were granted $750. Over the years, Launch's farm purchasing power was strengthened, with grants totaling $15,000. Last month, Launch pledged to spend $75,000 of their own money for the 2017-2018 school year on local farm food for preschool and school-age programs. Some of the farm delivery is still on a table as kids gather round. Austin Becker decides to throw a pop quiz.
So could you guys go down the line? Do you think you could identify what all this is?
There's curly kale, carrots, and the unique Hakurai turnips. One item is as big as a basketball, but light green.
It's some sort of melon.
That's right.
Melon do.
It's a Navajo watermelon. It turns out they've had it before. It was a hit, says cook Teresa Alfonso Mendez.
I cut it in half, and it was like opening up cotton candy and just like watching it explode. But the kids were just eating it. They were like, it's so juicy and yummy.
Becker asks the kids which fruits or vegetables are their favorites.
I like carrots.
Watermelon carrots, yeah.
Fresh produce grown on local farms at Launch Learning. It's a winning proposition. This story was brought to you with support from the Human Links Foundation, engineering by Daniel Gunther. From the studios of the Jack Straw Cultural Center, this is Martha Baskin.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans, Chris Bricker, and Martha Baskin. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. KPTZ is embarking on an ambitious plan to expand our news operations in order to bring you daily news updates and more in-depth feature stories like those you hear on KPTZ Compass, and we are looking for help to make it happen. Volunteer opportunities range from preparing copy for newscasts to becoming a newsreader to editing and production work. If you might be interested in joining the KPTZ news team, drop us a line at news@kptz.org or stop by the station at the Mountain View Commons and fill out a volunteer application form. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.